I'm John Batchelor with Germanicus, Makaveleos. I am Gaius. We're by the Thames. We're speculating about when the negotiation might have worked for Jefferson Davis, Alexander Stevens, and the apparatus of the Confederate States of America. And we apply that analogous thinking to when did negotiation matter for Kiev, for NATO, for Washington. We now turn to NATO itself because Kiev will be forgotten in 20 years or 30 years. There'll be another Kiev somewhere. But NATO persists. Right now, Germanicus, British Foreign Secretary warns U.S. is risking the West's security over Ukraine aid bloc. And Israel pulls ground troops from Gaza to prepare for future operations. And China sending Russia rifle scopes, tank parts, and rocket fuel. And Russia warns of negative consequences after 230 million Armenia-EU deal. All this chaos adds up to NATO watching. NATO is convinced. I don't think they're just making noise. They're convinced they will be attacked. The Baltics are convinced that the attack will come there. Some people see Moldova as the easiest target, but Moscow doesn't do things the easy way. The Romanians, I talked to them last week. The spirit in Bucharest is we're on the front lines. It's the Danube. That's all that's between us and Putin. All this adds up to NATO preparing for a war, a Cold War, a permanent conversation. They're meeting this summer in Washington. At that point, Kiev will be the least problem they have. They've got to arm. They've got to rebuild everything. Russia's on a war economy. How do you measure? Just a few minutes here, Germanicus. How do you measure NATO? What is the story NATO is going to tell itself after the Ukraine war?
Well, in our last segment, we talked about the inability of NATO and the U.S. to correctly assess the dynamics of the war and to live in a world of illusions. And I think this is an American problem, not necessarily a European problem, and I'll try and explain that. The U.S. has always enjoyed, that is, since 1945 and since the creation of NATO in 1949, hence the 75th anniversary, the U.S. has always enjoyed being the imperial leader, no different from Rome, and the relationship between the United States and NATO, also to Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, etc., has also been a Roman connection. In other words, these countries are titularly independent and treated with great deference in ritual public ceremony. And yet, in reality, they are vassals of the United States. And the cynical hypocrisy, which is a disabling hypocrisy, is that the United States enjoys the reality of empire, but must publicly abjure its appearance. So the U.S. denies that it's an empire. Oh, this is an alliance. We're all equals, and the U.S. is merely, you know, primus inter pares, first among equals, which is not true. And what you're seeing in NATO now is that the U.S., having set up, inspired, fed, and triggered a war with Russia and corralled NATO into being intimately engaged in this combat, proxy though it is, with the Russian Federation, now Europeans can see that entire enterprise on the verge of crashing down, like the bridge in Baltimore being hit by a container ship. This is all an endeavor that was feckless from the start and is about to come down. And here are a bunch of vassals, a lot of vassals. And these are not vibrant states any longer. They all have through-the-floor fertility rates. They're all declining in population. They have no more sense of energy. They're riven internally. They are absolutely dependent on the United States for security, and thus all of their paranoia and hysteria and their clamoring for sudden rearming and all the rest is a desperate cry for attention from the imperial court in Washington, a desperate exclamation of help me, reassure me, tell me it's going to be all right.
Well, it
do
worked
something.
In December of 1941. Will it work again? They were on their backs. They were done. And then Germany declared war on Roosevelt, and we were off.
The thing about that analogy is that, yes, in 1939 and 40, the U.S. was the lifeline to Britain and France. We were feeding them the entire product of our aviation industry, our munitions, everything. It was like a gigantic proxy war with Ukraine. They weren't officially allies, but they were absolutely dependent on us then.
Will Washington be sympathetic if Europe is broken? I mean, you're setting up a situation where they want our attention. They're not going to get it until the election, maybe not even after that.
What they want reassurance. They're desperately afraid that if Mr. Trump is the victor, that they'll be cast off. And as a result, they're highly agitated. So all of this talk about putting French corps d'armée in some sort of narcissistic excess of rhetoric is really a desperate cry for help. And so the U.S. is going to have to find a way, not simply out of the Ukraine war, but also to find a way to pacify and stroke Europe so that it calms down and remains in the U.S. orbit. Europe is so dependent on the U.S. and so beaten down now that the Germans have willingly sacrificed their economy to the war. Their industry is fleeing overseas. There is a terrible recession, and this is all an American creation.
Well,
and yet
after the election,
we're more dependent than ever.
After the election, what does NATO look like? Not between now and January, but after January, when there's a new presidency, does Europe appeal to us as broken, as helpless?
No, Europe was in actually much better shape during the Cold War because we needed all their forces, and they were relatively robust forces. In the case of Germany, they were superb forces, and thus they had some standing with the U.S. What we're seeing today is the slow transition that you saw in the Mediterranean world in the second to first centuries B.C., where the former great powers like Europe of the Hellenistic world, Macedonia, the Seleucids, Ptolemaic Egypt, even the realm of Mithridates, they were all reduced over the course of a century or more into absolute subservience to Rome. And that is what we're seeing. In other words, we have achieved our great goal of creating an American empire in Europe, Japan, Korea, Taiwan. And that is wonderful for our vanity, but it does not translate into strategic gravity. It does not give us anything. It makes us weaker. In other words, the NATO of the 1960s enhanced American power because it was a mobilized NATO that the U.S. could wield in the Cold War against the Soviet Union. However, a completely beaten down and passive and dependent NATO is an albatross around the neck.
And what will January look like? An enlivened NATO or a NATO in tatters?
NATO cannot come apart because of the overwhelming fear, anxiety, hysteria. And whatever person is the next president, that person, I guess I can say he, will be in a position to barter with NATO as a Constantinian Caesar.
Germanicus is Makovlejos. I am Gaius. We're by the Thames River. It's late in the evening. It's springtime. It's lovely. We're going to go on to a proverb lesson by a Greek, no doubt. We'll learn something ironic. But before that, Germanicus and I have been talking about the summer of 1932. And when we come back, some thoughts. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.